Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
Yes, the Newark Book Festival, an awesome event that gets better and better each year. And although I must admit, I said to Sarah, it's a pity there's not a great deal of science fiction actually on hand at the Newark Book Festival. Actually, I was wrong, because you could actually look at the work of End of Story as being a dystopian in which fiction has been banned by the government. Who's responsible for this awesome thriller? End of Story, of course. It is Louise Beach. How are you, Louise?
Hello there. Lovely to see you again and speak to you again. As we just said, it feels like just a moment ago.
I know. Well, you see, that's time. As Einstein once said, the only persistent illusion is that time all past, present and future occurs at once, really. But let's not go philosophical at this time of the day. It's too much. We can't cope with that. Let's talk a little bit about, obviously, work End of Story, a dystopian in which fiction has been banned by the government. Writing novels is a crime, and reading fairy tales to children is punishable by law. On the one hand, you might say, oh, yes, completely a work of fiction. But regrettably, there are many parts of the world in which actually books are being banned. And indeed, people might actually say that the recent furore over whether we should even allow things such as Of Mice and Men scenario and John Steinbeck's fictions are also there. Before, I mean, I'm not going to talk about the woke movement and so on, but it's not too beyond the realms of possibility to see that this could be an actuality. And is that something which is at the heart of the message that you've put into the text?
Well, it was actually my lockdown book. I think every writer's got one. You know, we're seeing a lot of them come out now, aren't we? Sort of 2 or 3 years on. And so it was during lockdown, which was obviously a very dark time. And it was something I'd always wanted to write, something a bit speculative, but I didn't know what. And then it was when Rishi Sunak, who was then the Chancellor, not the Prime Minister, said that many of us in the arts during COVID should just retrain. And I was obviously quite angry about that as an artist. And I just thought, what would the world be like if we didn't have fiction, if we didn't have stories? Especially during lockdown, when obviously everything we were doing to entertain ourselves was the arts, wasn't it? You know, watching Netflix, reading books, listening to music while we were in the house. And so I said to my husband, and he said, well, Louise, write this world. And I thought, he's right. So I sat down and came up with this idea of a slightly future. It's 2035. And very slowly over the last 5 years, the government have insidiously had a campaign at first to censor books, which now is very topical, didn't know then, and then ultimately to ban them. So, yeah, quite a dark world.
Of course, writers have been known to reflect on this particular aspect in times past. I mean, Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, the future in which firemen would actually start fires as opposed to putting them out, and books were considered as actually carrying ideas and making people unhappy. So the best solution to actually stop people being unhappy is simply actually take away the source of that unhappiness, which are the ideas found in books. I mean, here we are, as I say, in the approaching the second quarter of the 21st century. Is it a case of we got life imitating art, imitating life again? I mean, you've cited, obviously, Rishi Sunak's thing there, because there are certain folk who would actually not like people to actually read and get those ideas from texts, even if those texts are like 18 seconds and so on.
Hey, do you know what? In this world, 18 seconds would be okay because it's nonfiction. Here's the irony. That would be allowed to be on the shelf because nonfiction, you know, is still on the shelves. It's just fiction that's banned. It's because in this book, and perhaps in the real world a little bit, sometimes maybe the higher powers get a little bit frightened, don't they, when writers voice their opinions, and they often voice those opinions via fiction, don't they? In the stories that they tell, they'll express how they feel. And perhaps, you know, in this world that I've created, they want to control that. They don't like us having these ideas. But as I say, had I known where we would be now with, you know, I think it's in Florida. I know someone who lives in Florida who said certain books in schools and libraries have just been banned, like outright banned. And, you know, personally, I don't think banning's the way forward, in my humble opinion. You know, I think we should be free to choose what we read, and we can make those choices. And perhaps there could be, I don't know, a little note at the front saying this was of its time. Certain language isn't used now, but it reflects that time. I don't know. It's a tricky one, isn't it? We'd have to talk about that for hours, I suppose, to get to the root of that.
Absolutely. I mean, I say over the last year, of course, we've also seen the furore that Roald Dahl and the Roald Dahl estate actually had. Ian Fleming, of course, James Bond, likewise. I mean, I know that publishers backtracked slightly with respect to that. But, you know, hypothetically, how would you feel if in, say, the year 2085, some publisher said, "Oh, Louise Beach, end of story. I don't know. Maybe we need to rewrite that." I mean, my feeling is, look, you don't go back and actually rewrite Mozart. You don't go back and rewrite Beethoven. Or if you do, it's a completely different aspect from that point of view. It's literally Ben Jonson, Shakespeare. I mean, I know the translations can differ and there are lots of variations within that. But as a creator, would you, if you could project ahead? I mean, let's move a bit further, because you'd probably still be with us in 2085. So let's look at, say, I don't know, 3010. Yeah, from that perspective, would it be a case that you think, yeah, I'd be happy with that, or would you sort of think, if you were in Ian Fleming's position or Roald Dahl, would you think, hang on a minute, you know, what are we doing here?
Well, first of all, 2085, unless I'm 115, no, I probably won't be around then. But thank you very much for that kind comment. But if it's the 3000s, yeah. You know what? Here's the thing. What I found out afterwards with the Roald Dahl thing was that they did do amended versions, but they were keeping the original as well. So there was almost still a choice there. And those that maybe didn't want to read the original could read the amended. Now, that I don't have a problem with. For me, it would be, if you amended a version and then didn't have the original version. So if it was the future and they were amending a new version for a new audience but keeping the old, I don't suppose I'd mind that, because I think it's opening me up to a new audience wherever I am from heaven or hell watching, you know, this happening. But if it was to be amended and the old one discarded, yeah, I'd have a problem with that, yeah, because I wrote that book a certain way. And I would argue that in the future, it's of its time. And yes, it may have language that in the 3000s we don't use anymore. But yeah, let's put a note in the front just saying this was written in 2020. You know, these were the words we used then. We use different words now. So yeah, I'd have a problem if it was only going to be a certain version, but maybe not if there was a choice. The key word always, I don't know about you, is choice. This is what I don't like about banning things. The key word's just that we can choose which one we read, you know.
Very much so. Okay, we're talking futurism and we're negotiating that as the aspect develops. We'll talk about, obviously, A Life in Books and when people actually see you at the New York Book Festival in a few moments. But I have to ask you again, the current buzz kill in certain instances, possibly buzz in general, as far as education is actually concerned, are those immortal words, ChatGPT. The notion of artificial intelligence, producing texts and so on and so forth. Is this an asset? Is this something you think, yeah, I quite like using ChatGPT. It gives me an idea of what writing like Louise Beach is all about. Or is it a case of go away, horrible, nasty artificial intelligence? What are your thoughts?
Oh, definitely go away. Oh my God, no. For writers, it's a terrifying thought. And also for musicians, anyone who creates. You know what, as well? I've been reading that a lot of images for books may be, you know, created by AI rather than the artist, so the artist loses out on the job. Oh my word, anybody in the creative industry, no, it's a big no-no. We don't want artificial intelligence taking our jobs. I mean, yes, they could probably write something pretty close to my text because it's clever, but I'll tell you what it wouldn't have the beating heart, it wouldn't have the soul, and I don't think you can recreate that. And I'll tell you also, I think a sense of humour would be hard for them to... Do you know what I mean? I think that would be hard to include because it's a very human thing, is sense of humour. But definitely the beating heart. So no, it's a big no-no for me.
it is intriguing, though, that with many people even responsible for artificial intelligence developments warning that we need to have some kind of proviso in there. I was recently at a meeting with the University of Hong Kong, Baptist University, and they were very much embracing it and were saying it's a wonderful asset and we shouldn't view it as in any way, shape or form cheating. It should be a tool that they can actually use to open up things with. And a big part of me, actually, when I was part of this meeting, It was online, so clearly we have one step ahead there. And I was seeing my colleagues embracing the words, etc. And a big part of me was saying, "Do you realize what you're actually saying here? Do you realize the challenges that you actually got within that?" I'm not a Luddite by any means, but it was something which concerned me from the point of view of how do you actually develop that side of the human equation, where we can deal with automata. We can actually become automata. Lord knows there are times today where I feel as though I'm simply switching into automation side of things, etc. But we still have to somehow not elevate the machine above the human. Otherwise, we are going to lose out.
Yeah, I think that's the key, isn't it? Yeah, the human element always has to be there. Wow, it's quite scary. It's quite scary how fast it's happened. Do you know what I mean? It just seems like suddenly it's
It's
here.
like
I know we've
COVID,
been moving.
suddenly we've moved from
Yeah,
COVID to a chat GPT.
it's yeah, but some writers, very small minority, I must say, have talked about how it could be helpful, like you said, in generating ideas and getting maybe an idea started. But I personally don't have a problem with that. I've always got a million ideas. I don't have that problem. And I'm certainly not going to turn to AI. I'll still just turn to either my daughter or my husband when we're having a chat. I will bounce ideas off them.
Good to hear it, Louise. Even though it could be argued philosophically that we are also, as human beings, simply machines, just the machines that are biochemical in nature. I'm sure Richard
Yes.
Dawkins would be into that. But that's another issue. And there is, of course, that other one, which maybe we should actually do a joint text about. Perhaps COVID was actually created by ChatGPT or artificial intelligence.
Gosh. Oh dear me. Oh, don't tell me these things. I mean, I've got enough things to write about,
Well, let's move to 18 Seconds, which is, as we said, a memoir, and it's a memoir of horror and forgiveness that explores how family can be the best thing in your life and the worst thing in your life. Share with us, in a sense, how that came to the fore and how obviously you decided to say, yeah, I'm going to deal with this. That's why I've called my session at the New York Book Festival, Louise Beach, A Life in Books.
Yeah. Well, the memoir. So I had always thought I would write a memoir, but number one, I knew I had to be a certain age because there's nothing worse, is there, than somebody who's 22 writing their life story. I knew
Like
I had to be
David
a certain
Beckham.
I just, so I knew I had to be a certain age and also of a certain ability. I thought I need to get a few books under my belt so that maybe I'm able. And also, I did want to talk about I had a very, very difficult childhood. But I knew I needed a really good angle and a good hook. Otherwise, it would just be like the many memoirs out there. And then in 2019, my mum jumped off the Humber Bridge. Now, she did survive. I'm always very quick to say that. She did survive. Left with horrific injuries. Her leg was eventually amputated. She's a wheelchair user. And obviously, the family spent 6 months, obviously, dealing with that while she was in hospital for 6 months, caring for her. Many times we thought we might lose her. But then 9 months on, when we were kind of recovering from that, I realized as a writer, that's the hook. That is, if I read a first chapter and that was the opening, I would probably read on to find out how have we got to this. So I knew that I had my way to write the memoir. And so it was a modern timeline of that going on with flashbacks to the childhood and the difficult mother relationship that I have and what led to this. So yeah, so I wrote that one actually just before lockdown, and then lockdown started halfway through writing it, which made it quite intense to write, locked in the house, writing this difficult subject matter. So yeah, it was very intense, but very cathartic, very cathartic.
A line I've used over the years is that parents are very difficult to bring into the world, and maybe that could also be a kind of strap line in many ways for 18 seconds.
Yes.
But a tough call from that perspective. Okay, New York Book Festival last year was the sixth. This is the seventh. What are your expectations? As obviously the fans of Louise Beach, or as I like to refer to us, the Beachettes, will effectively be gathering en masse at 10:30 a.m. on a Sunday, the 9th of July. What are you kind of excited about? Or is it a case of, yeah, well, I'll turn up, I'll do my stuff, and I'll get out as quickly as possible? Because after all, it's a different county. I'm a Humberside girl, not Lincolnshire.
Oh my word, you don't realize, seriously, I love doing events like this because one of my favorite things, aside from the actual writing, is genuinely meeting readers, talking about the books, and getting out there in the world because it's quite a solitary life sitting at the computer writing. So I absolutely love it. Now, sadly, I can't be there as long as I would like to be. Last year, I was there 2 days. I am actually going to a gig with my daughter in London. And then on the Saturday, travelling up home, but I'm going to get off the train early, come to Newark Saturday evening. So sadly, I'm only there Saturday evening until Sunday afternoon, but I might catch a few events. So I might not be in your lovely town as long as I want to be, but I'll try and do as much.
Louise, I'm from Middlesbrough and I work in Lincoln. I mean, I like to go to Newark, but you know, you can say anything about Newark as far as I'm concerned, as long as you don't confuse it with Newark, New Jersey.
Okay, yeah, but a little bit bigger, Newark, New Jersey. So I'm always excited. I will just, as always, talk freely. I'll answer any questions. There'll always be some good humour in there. I always, you know, like good hearty humour. Yeah, that'll be it.
And that humour will not be generated by ChatGPT, so at least we've identified that, which is very important. Could happen, I'm sure. Louise, how can people follow you on the socials, on the various other ways, if for whatever crazy reason they're unable to actually catch up with you in person at the New York Book Festival?
Okay, for some crazy reason they can't. So I am at Louise Writer on Twitter, and I'm quite active on there, and I'll always engage in conversation. I love doing that. I am at Louise Beach, also Swanson, on Instagram because of the two names. And on Facebook, I'm just Louise Beach, so I'm easy to find there. I have a website, www.louisebeach.co.uk. Yeah, I think that covers all of those. But yeah, I'm always happy to speak and connect with people.
Well, there we are. And you will be in conversation with Tim Rideout, of course, who has got a range of sort of experiences himself, talking about your life in books at 10:30 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. So one English hour, New York Town Hall, which is a lovely place. And tickets still, I think, just about available, ranging from £4 to £7. A snip less than the cost of a cup of coffee in certain places, actually, or maybe just about sort of cup of coffee thing from that point of view. So there we are. And think about the nutrition for the mind that that's going to provide. I mean, awesome. And it's Louise Beach, A Life in Books. We have two final questions, Louise, of course, which are the kind of pro forma ones for all of our authors of the week, etc., and general author features. Number one, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
Oh, I've loved it. Do you know what? Seriously, because we just sit and write and get on, as I said earlier, it's so nice sometimes to take a break from it and see a human face. So, yes, absolutely.
I can guarantee that I, as far as I'm aware, haven't actually been replaced by artificial intelligence as yet. But having said that, you know, that there's always the danger that at any particular time one could actually sort of suddenly become changed into something completely different. And you know, who knows what could happen on that basis. But next question. Can we look forward to connecting with you again? And let's not leave it a year next time. Would you be willing to actually take part in one of our programs, which we do on a weekly basis, either via Zoom or who knows, maybe even in person?
I will always do anything. Honestly, if I'm available and I can get there, Zoom or in the flesh, just ask. I will always do my best. Yes.
Well, I have to say, I'm a little bit worried. We've just heard Louise Beach waxing lyrical about her views and thoughts, etc. But the day before Louise Beach is actually present at the festival, we have got what could arguably be seen as a terrific triumvirate of fabulous individuals at the New York Book Festival. We're delighted to actually welcome one of that triumvirate to the programme today. That, of course, is the author and creator of The Lost Man of Bombay. It's all part of the wondrous world of the Malabar House series. And it is, of course, the fabulous author extraordinaire, Vaseem Khan. How are you, Vaseem?
I'm really, really well, although now slightly worried because your mention of a triumvirate takes me back a couple of thousand years to the last time there was a popular triumvirate, which didn't really end very well for the members, for most of the members of that. So we're going back to Roman times, obviously, and Caesar.
Yeah, it's okay. I think we're okay. I mean, as far as I can actually tell, Steph Broadrib and indeed Tim Glister will be okay. And if all else fails, we are in good hands with Nick Quantrill, who's a fellow crime writer, who I'm sure will actually keep everything sorted out on that basis. So that's by the way. The other thing that worried me slightly, Vaseem, is your offer that is featured on your website that people will actually purchase one of the books, and quite rightly so, they should get lost one of Bombay. You've actually said, come to tea anytime, twice on Sundays. You could have thousands, hundreds of thousands of people sort of marching their way to check you out and say, I claim my cup of tea with you, Vasim. I've bought your book.
However, they clearly didn't see the small print, because nowhere have I said that I'm actually going to be here. So it's going to be my wife's problem.
There we are. Delegation to the fore. Okay, enough of such frivolity. Let's talk a little bit more about some of the awesome material that you have actually produced, of course. And let's talk about The Lost Man of Bombay, of course. A dead white man is found frozen in the Himalayas with only a notebook containing cryptic clues. It's India, 1950, of course. Meanwhile, in Bombay, two more Europeans are killed. You certainly are actually teasing away with respect to that. And it's no surprise, Vasim, that this was picked in the top crime books of the year by The Guardian.
Well, yeah, so probably some context for your listeners. So the series, the Malabar House series, is set in 1950 in India, as you rightly point out. And that's just a few years after Indian independence in 1947. And the country is still overshadowed by the horrors of partition and Gandhi's assassination. So India is a very turbulent environment at the time, trying to work out what kind of country it's going to be following 300 years of the British presence on the subcontinent. And at the same time, you've got my lead character, who is a woman, India's first female police detective, who qualifies, and nobody knows what to do with her because, you know, they've never had a woman at that level in the police force before. So they throw her into Bombay's smallest police station, Malabar House, with the rest of the rejects and the misfits. And then she has to survive. And during the course of so that first novel, Midnight at Malabar House, we introduce her, and she has to solve the murder of a senior English diplomat. And she finds herself working with an Englishman named Archie Blackfinch, who's a forensic scientist from the Met Police, who goes out to India to help Bombay set up its own forensic science lab. And in a sense, both of these characters are personifying the two forces at work in India, because you've got Indians who've come through this colonial period, and Persis is one of them. She's been in that independence movement. And now she's forced to work with an Englishman who, you know, clearly he's part of those colonizing entity that ruled over India for so long. But at the same time, on a higher level, India has to work with England. They can't just shun England, because England is still a global superpower and India needs that economic and political relationship. And in The Lost Man of Bombay, I just continue that exploration of that period.
The best historical thriller of the year, according to the Daily Express. Interesting, I didn't initially see it as a historical thriller, but arguably, yes. I mean, we are talking nigh on, 70 to 80 years since partition actually occurred and the thing actually applied. So how much research did you actually do, Vasim, in terms of digging back to those pre-internet, pre-Zoom days, the days where actually telephones were actually in use to actually ramp up the tension?
Well, I mean, I was born and grew up in the UK, right? But at the age of 23, I was lucky and fortunate enough to go out to India to work. I was a management consultant and I spent an amazing decade there. And I saw this modern India, which was changing because of the outsourcing bonanza and westernization flow, the westernization culture flowing into the country. And you know, once I'd done that, I wrote a series that was set in modern, contemporary India. But then I started thinking, where did this modern India that we now see come from? And although India is thousands of years old in terms of a culture, my personal feeling was that this modern India was largely founded in that period just after Indian independence. Many of the things that we take for granted today were the roots of those things were established in that period. So to answer your question, I had to do an enormous amount of research, but it was part and parcel of me trying to discover my own heritage, so to speak, because my parents were obviously from the subcontinent, but I'd never been there before until I went out there to work. And the thing with historical crime fiction is that you do all of this research and then you find that you have to jettison about 98 or 99% of it. Because ultimately what you're trying to offer people, and this goes back to the point you made about you didn't think it was a thriller, but with these kind of books, what is paramount is that the narrative moves forward. You know, you start with a murder. Crime fiction readers, crime thriller readers, they expect an intellectual challenge. They expect the story to move forward in pursuit of solving that intellectual challenge. And that's the kind of book that I try and write.
You mentioned, obviously, you work as a management consultant. Does that help in terms of plotting nefarious activities? Are there times when you've been sitting in at meetings and you thought, I wonder what would be the most creative way to actually do away with that individual?
More than once. You'd be surprised, Alex. Different crime writers approach the business of writing a crime novel in different ways. And I've been very fortunate. You know, I've had 9 novels with a big publisher, and I've got an audience around the world now, and more people continue to discover these books. But these books also allow me to talk about topics that I care about, you know, about post-colonialism and that period where England and India were renegotiating their relationship. But they also allow me to go back to my youth, because I first fell in love with crime fiction through Agatha Christie and watching the amazing David Suchet-led Poirot series, which I used to watch with my late dad. And it always used to amaze me why he loved it so much, because his English wasn't very good. And I can only assume it was because he had a magnificent mustache, very much like Poirot's. So the books that I write now are in that same mold. In fact, Midnight at Malabar House, the first in the series, The Observer commented in their review that it was very much the style was very much in the Agatha Christie mold. And see how things can come full circle, because last year I was invited to speak at the International Agatha Christie Festival in her hometown in Torquay, which for me was one of those amazing author moments that sort of decades later from when you first encountered a literary hero of yours, you get to go and pay homage in their hometown and at a festival named in their honor.
So more of an Agatha Christie fan than an Edgar Allan Poe or an Arthur Conan Doyle fan. Is that fair to say?
Well, yes, to a certain extent, because my books are, you know, what they might be described as Golden Age style fiction, mm-hmm. although, of course, it's 1950, slightly outside the Golden Age period. But the violence is largely off stage. You don't have overt lewdness. There's no swearing. The blood and gore is again off stage. It's about setting readers an intellectual challenge. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've seen in recent years the resurgence of that kind of crime fiction with the Richard Osman books and the Janice Hallett series. And readers seem around the world now seem to respond to that kind of crime fiction where, you know, someone like me sets them a challenge. And then we set a load of clues and cryptic. There's a lot of cryptic clues and things in my particular novels, the Malabar House books. And the challenge is, can you solve this mystery before I give you the answers? And readers really seem to enjoy that.
Of course, the continued popularity of G.K. Chesterton and Father Brown is a testament to the whole essence of the cozy crime series. I think it's sometimes been referred to. But I'm pleased to see, Vaseem, that you can guarantee that sensitive readers, when they pick up one of the Malabar House series, they won't actually be faced with a barrage of F-bombs being dropped. Because sometimes I feel, you know, there are too many F-bombs being used in literature today, and it tends to use impact. Maybe that's just a personal thing.
There are no F-bombs. There are a few C-bombs, as in cake bombs.
Wow.
Some of my characters like a bit of cake now and again.
Yeah. See, this is the idea. I mean, this is why Sarah Bollimore clearly booked you for the festival. It was critical on that basis. Looking ahead, before we talk about your role at the festival, we see that the fourth book in the Malabar House series, Death of a Lesser God, is already available for pre-order. So great stuff as far as that's concerned. I mean, are there any indications of the Malabar House series slowing down? Is it a case of, no, I love it, there's more to come? Why do you think I did all that research that I couldn't fit in the first few books?
Well, there's two sides to this argument, right? So as a writer, I love writing these books. I feel there's so many stories to tell about India, because it's such a vast place with such an enormous history. And trying to cram those into just two or three books is impossible. So I'm more than happy to create more stories. Now, Death of a Lesser God. Yes, you're right. It's available for pre-order quite early. And the cover of that book says a lot, because it's my favorite cover of any of the books that I've had published. And the title is the only one that I've ever been allowed to keep that I came up with myself. And both the title and the amazing, there's a white tiger on the cover, they both speak to a central element of this book. So the book, just to quickly, it's about a white Englishman who was born and raised in India of that period, who lived through Indian independence, but who's now convicted of murdering an Indian lawyer. He has 11 days before his execution. He claims his innocence. He claims that there's a form of reverse racism at work here, where the Indians trying to punish him for the evils of empire. And so Persis is called in for a last ditch attempt to see whether or not he's telling the truth, or is he actually guilty or not. And, you know, that allows me to explore something that a lot of people don't know about of that post-independence period, which is that tens of thousands of foreigners, mainly English people, British people, stayed on after independence because they were born there. They knew no other home. They didn't want to come back to cold, wet, miserable England. And so were they treated fairly? Were they not treated fairly? That's the central question of that particular book.
Interesting, because I was thinking, was it a combination of Children of a Lesser God and possibly with the White Tiger, Life of Pi? But clearly I was completely wrong on that basis. So nothing to do with either of those particular predecessors.
Not entirely wrong. Not entirely. Some of those titles, all of those titles you mentioned, and all of which I've got, a couple of them are on my bookshelf back here, White Tiger and Life of Pi. All of those were in my mind when I was trying to formulate that particular title.
It's the old creative cosmos that's at work there, percolating its way in such manner that ChatGPT could only, in its wildest dreams, think about. So let's step away from that, because we've already
don't
had...
Don't get me started on ChatGPT.
I had a feeling you might say that, Vaseem, which is why I think we covered that with Louise earlier in the day. Let's talk about Newark Town Hall's grand event, of course, 1 p.m. through to 2 p.m. on Saturday, the 8th of July. Have you been to the Newark Book Festival before? Is this a regular? Is this a slot where you're jumping into the unknown? What are your kind of thoughts about Newark in general?
Well, I do a heck of a lot of events around the country and also abroad. I was in America a couple of weeks ago. I'm off to a Canadian Book Fest next week. I am incredibly intrigued about coming to Newark. I believe it's my first time there, and I've heard amazing things. Now, you say it's like jumping into a shark tank, did you say? Well, I'm more than happy. I'm a crime writer, more than happy to jump into the shark tank with fellow crime writers.
Fantastic. Well, of course, as I say, there is that triple whammy. Well, actually, in many ways, it's a quartet of quality, because let's not forget Nick Quantrill is quite a key writer from Humberside as well. And he'll obviously be chairing the whole thing. But the theme is very much traveling around the world, our world, which, of course, is an underlying theme of the festival, experiencing a wide variety of places, times and perspectives. We've obviously mentioned yourself, Vaseem, with respect to post-colonial India and the Lost Man of Bombay. Steph Broadrib is going to be talking about contemporary America with Death at Paradise Palms. And Tim Gilster, who's also on the panel with A Game of Deceit, will actually be talking about, I suppose, transnational boundaries with the murky world of espionage. I mean, the crime genre thing, I used to think that science fiction was one of those genres which was unique insofar as it generated such passion from its fans. But I think crime is a close second in many ways. And in certain instances, such as the Harrogate Crime Festival, etc., tends to exceed it, really. So share with us, I mean, you've shared with us your line about why you liked Agatha Christie, etc. Has crime as a genre always been something you thought, yeah, I like those intellectual challenges?
Yeah, so, I mean, you mentioned Harrogate. I mean, I'm the chair of the Harrogate Festival this year. So, you know, it's been my great honor to do that in its 20th anniversary year and to put together a program of writers from around the world who will come and talk about their passion. And I guess Newark is very similar. When you put four crime writers together, we talk about our passions, but we're also very collegiate as a group. You know, we love our crime fiction, but we also understand that crime fiction is just a vehicle to transport our readers to places and to times and to periods and to situations that we feel passionate about. And for people who would come to our session, you're going to be transported to India, as you mentioned. You're going to be transported to America. You're going to be transported to the Cold War era through Tim's work. Isn't that what fiction is for? Isn't that the whole reason for fiction's existence? To be able to take us away from our day-to-day lives and to entertain, but to also inform and to give us a window on the world, on places and periods and issues that we might not be able to get to grips with on a daily basis.
You mentioned your international journeys and so on. How do people relate to your good self in other countries, Canada and so on? Do they actually think, oh, a quaint British soul talking about his quaint British books? Or is it a case of, no, they sort of have a different line? Because we do a regular Author of the Week feature in which we feature an awful lot of Canadian and American crime writers and so on. And I'm just fascinated in terms of how your perception of their perception of yours actually is.
It's an odd one because, yes, people are different in different parts of the world. And, you know, I have readers in various parts of the world now after a decade of having my books published. And it's interesting because I get a lot of mail from around the world, and different readers have different takes on what they've actually got out of these books. I get this every year when my new book comes out, I get an email from a very small island off the coast of Canada in British Columbia, where everybody in the island apparently loves my books. And they sort of one bookshop or library, I can't remember where they get these books from. And then they all have a little natter about it. And then they get someone to send me an email talking about, you know, what it is that they, being an island off the coast of Canada, have got from these books that are set in India, you know, miles and miles and miles away from them. But they clearly are getting something out of it. And it's the same that I feel. When I read a book that's set way outside of my own frame of reference, my experience, the joy that I get from something of that nature, it also helps, I think, that I am all of my books, both my first series and my second, they have a gentle note of humor infused through them, because I think that humor can be used sometimes, not slapstick, just a gentle note to try and not only entertain people, but to allow us to explore darker and deeper issues such as post-colonialism and inequality and all murder, of course, and all the rest of it. It just allows us to alleviate that and bring it up from the page so that people can have a good time while being knee deep in blood, guts and murder and the rest of it.
Well, speaking about having a good time, of course, we alluded earlier to the fact that, well, at least your wife's going to be very generously providing tea and coffee for anybody who turns up and actually says, I've got the book, let's have our tea. But the location online, vaseemkhan.com, is packed with a wealth of scenarios. I see the Red Hot Chili Writers podcast is flagged up. There's a writing course in which you can actually guide people through how to actually develop their own crime fiction ideas and so on. And of course, there's your viewpoint with respect to blog entries and so on. That multi aspect of writers, which has really, with social media and with obviously the web, become almost a vital part of a writer's armory. Is that something which you kind of had? Is there a grand plan that you actually have in terms of, yes, this is Vaseem Khan's guide to conquering the world of literature and crime fiction, at least? Or is it a case of, you know, actually these are fun areas that can be developed, such as I say, the Red Hot Chili Writers podcast, presumably no nod in the direction to Red Hot Chili Peppers, clearly.
It is a nod in that direction. I think it depends on your personality. Now, I spent 20 years and 7 novels being rejected by the publishing industry. You know, I wrote my first novel when I was 17 and sent it into agents. It was a kind of a Terry Pratchett Discworld ripoff, because I love Pratchett and he's the reason I'm a writer today, if I'm completely honest. And so for me, when I was published at the age of 40, about a decade ago now almost, it was an astonishing surprise. I didn't expect it at that stage. And so for me, everything that I do now is about trying to maximize my time and the fun that I get out of being not just a writer of books, but about somebody within the industry who can maybe pass on some information to those who are coming up behind me, so that they don't have to go through that long 20-year period of...
There's always management consultancy for Seam, surely.
Yeah, maybe I should have a management consultant who's also a detective on the side. It's just an incredible honor to be in this position at this moment. And if nothing else, the one thing that I can say to people, hopefully people who are listening to this and who are either going to decide to read my books or to come along to Newark Festival and watch me speak, for me, it's an incredible honor. And anybody who reads something that I've written, I still find it fabulously amazing and astonishing that anybody would want to read anything that I've written. So I take nothing for granted. And, you know, I just thank everybody who helps.
It's been a privilege sharing some thoughts with your good self today, Vaseem. Of course, a reminder, I think some tickets are still just about available for, as we said, less than the price of, well, a decent cup of tea, let alone coffee, £4 to £7, basically. £4 for Festival Friends, £7 for the thing. It's at the Newark Town Hall in the wonderful world of Newark. That's Newark, Nottinghamshire, not Newark, New England, New Jersey, just in case people get confused. Sometimes it happens. So it's Newark Town Hall, 8th of July, Saturday, 8th of July, 2023. Vaseem, we've got two final questions to wrap up with. Have you had, number one, a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
More than interesting. And I love your final comment about how it's the price of a coffee that people are paying to come and see these writers speak. And when we tell you that it takes a year of hard sweat and toil to write a book, and what I can promise you is this: if you pay your money and you come to Newark and you come to listen to me and to the others speak, you will get 10 times that value in terms of entertainment from us.
Absolutely. Consider me there. Next and final question. Can we prevail upon you to join us again in the not too distant future and be another one of our authors of the week? Will you be kind enough to join us either via Zoom or other modes of communication?
That is lovely of you to ask, and I am at your disposal. I have plenty of other stories about India and writing, which we didn't have time for today. So more than happy to come back whenever you require me to.
Travel is at a tipping point. Tourists are unintentionally destroying the very things they have come to see. Overtourism has magnified its impact on the environment, wildlife, and vulnerable communities around the globe. The descriptor from a recently released documentary that is now available on all major platforms, and it's entitled The Last Tourist. A very significant range of things coming across here, and we're delighted to actually welcome the executive producer of The Last Tourist to the programme today to discuss some of the issues it raises, especially about the dark side of the tourism industry. That's the wonderful Bruce Poontip. How are you, Bruce?
I'm great, thank you.
Excellent. Well, I've got to say, I've already purchased the documentary. I was shocked by the actual content. It really raises so many key issues about what we, arguably in the Western world, if we're thinking about planning our summer holidays and heading off to pastures new and so on and so forth, faraway destinations and faraway names, really need to think again with respect to some of the ways in which these countries are suffering, and I use the term deliberately, partly because of unsustainable tourism. I mean, were you shocked by this, Bruce, or was it a case of, well, we kind of knew this, we just needed to actually get it documented?
Well, I am in the travel industry, so I knew quite a bit about it. And that was really the motivation of the film, because I've been in travel for over 34 years. And, you know, we originally thought of just doing a short film to highlight some of the issues, because I do a lot of public speaking on more so on the positive side of what travel can be, the potential of tourism, not necessarily where we were, but the potential of what we could be. But once we started digging into creating a storyline and going through the creative process of putting The Last Tourist together, I guess that's when it became a much bigger issue. And it became much bigger than, you know, my company or just creating a corporate vanity film about travel. It was a much bigger issue that tourism faces in general.
Now, I've obviously travelled within Europe and across areas from that point of view. I haven't actually been fortunate enough to actually travel globally from that point of view. But actually now looking at the situation, quite apart from the climate problems with respect to aircraft transport, etc., I must admit, really devastated by some of the ways in which we see children being exploited for profit. We see Instagram moments being created, so animals are often basically treated very cruelly. I mean, this really, in so many ways, kind of was, for me, as impactful about the tourist industry as at the start of the century, an uncomfortable truth was when Al Gore made that about the climate change industry. I mean, mm-hmm. Clearly, you know, part of the headlines that we got here are problematic. But for people who are actually thinking, oh, it's okay, we're a sustainable tourist, we're actually going to help the economy, we're dealing with volunteerism, something else we've addressed on this program in the past, maybe there are a whole range of issues there that, again, as one of the contributors to the documentary actually says, we need to have a completely different mindset when it comes to tourism.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the tourist, I think the average traveler is a bit confused. I mean, if you look at the evolution of trying to define tourism over the last, you know, almost 25 years. It started with ecotourism and then responsible tourism and now sustainable tourism. They were all kind of different eras of kind of looking at tourism, and but there's ultimately, you know, it's redefining the same thing: how travel can have a positive impact as opposed to a negative impact, and what do we have to do to get there. And The Last Tourist, I guess, presents ideas. You know, I keep saying that, you know, The Last Tourist doesn't, I don't think it shows people anything that they didn't know. You probably haven't had to confront it like you do when you watch The Last Tourist, but ultimately it's a positive message of hope that, you know, travel can be so much more. And it doesn't have to be a one-way conversation where only the traveler benefits. You know, you could bring more people into the supply chain, and more people benefit when you decide you want to go on holiday.
The travel industry is a very lucrative industry. It raises billions of pounds. We know this. But not a great deal of that money that's actually being raised seems to be making its way to the poor in the various countries that are being visited. I mean, is that... A call for a redistribution of wealth, because I can already see people basically getting very annoyed about saying, we can't have that ideology, we've got to work on this system, etc. But are we really in this situation where, you know, we go there, we say, how wonderful, we headed off to X, Y, or Z particular part of the planet, helped out a little bit, then we came back again, basically. I mean, do we need to think about a tourist footprint as much as we do a carbon footprint?
I think we do. I mean, I really believe that we do. I mean, you know, we're buying luxury holidays in some of the poorest countries in the world, the most in-need citizens on the planet. And it's really about an opportunity. It's not necessarily, you know, the negative. You know, it's not only just about negative. It's about the opportunity that we have as an industry, as a traveler, to, you know, for travel to be a positive thing. I mean, that's really the goal. Like, you know, UNEP, United Nations Environment Program, has done studies saying that, you know, only between $5 and $10 of every dollar spent on a mainstream holiday actually stays in the economy. Ultimately, that's not a sustainable model. You know, we have a vast majority of public companies promising infinite growth and infinite profits, but we don't have an infinite amount of iconic destinations in the world. We have a limited amount of places people want to visit. So the business models don't work, and they're not sustainable long-term. And so the best way to do it is to look at how travel can be transformational and bring more communities and create dialogue with communities to bring them into the supply chain. So the idea is about, you know, cultural heritage preservation because of tourism. Poverty alleviation can be because of tourism. And it's not just the negatives of carbon emissions or flights or the environment. There's just many ways in which we can define success on how travel can be, a force for good.
The COVID pandemic in many ways forced the whole range of mindsets to be re-evaluated, and certainly when it came to tourism, effectively it ceased to be, more or less, for a 16 to 18 month period. Have we learned any lessons from that particular period, or was it just a case of, no, we've just bounced back now and we're just as consumer heavy and crazy as ever we were pre-pandemic?
No, I think we have. I mean, we were never going to, you know, we were forced as an industry, we were forced into this hibernation, and it did create a lot of dialogue and a lot of conversations and, you know, and across industries as well, you know, between the hospitality and cruise and the resort, and, you know, everyone was kind of talking how we could use this pause to get better. Now, I don't think we were ever going to get rid of mainstream travel altogether, or was going to, you know, we were going to get rid of cruises or compound resort all-inclusives. That was never going to happen. There's always going to be a market for that. But it's how they can do it better, how they can understand how, you know, and those conversations are being had for the first time. But it really, there is a small group of people that did change, that are traveling differently, because, you know, COVID didn't go away. So there's inherent risk to travel now. And so if you want to travel, it has to be relatively important to you. And you have to be purposeful on why you want to travel. And it has to be meaningful to you. And that's the best place we can be in the travel industry, when travel is meaningful. And you want to go to, you need to travel because, you know, it's an intrinsic part of your existence, or it's because it's something that you want. It's important to you. And you're not just buying amenities. You're not just shopping for capacity and amenities and commoditizing experience.
Being in the 21st century, we often rely heavily on technology. We're doing that for the basis of this interview. Do you feel that there are technological solutions? I mean, I'm just interested in terms of your thoughts vis-a-vis space tourism that is being touted as the next stage further forward. Or is it a case of sometimes we need to actually ensure we think, as you rightly said, mindfully and carefully about where we're going to effectively move to next?
Well, I mean, tourism and travel always moves in parallel with society. The idea of we're constantly looking to push more remotely or, travel the last frontiers, whether that's Galapagos Islands or Antarctica on Earth. So there's a natural progression for space travel. I mean, I don't think that that's not seen as tourism at this stage. There isn't kind of, but, that might be the future. That's not something that I think that the travel industry in general is looking at. But technology in general is a big part of, can be a big part of the solution on so many issues, not just within travel, but within the sustainability side. Whether that's, on the hotel industry where they're having, climate control within hotels, or trash compacting and technology for being more fuel efficient, or carbon capture. Carbon capture is really the solution for jet fuel and carbon emissions. And the addiction to, fossil fuels. So so technology is going to be a bi play a big part in the future of how we define the future of sustainability, and that it'll equally impact the tourism industry and how we travel.
You filmed The Last Tourist across 16 countries, from Peru to Cambodia, Mexico to Kenya. It's directed, of course, by Tyson Sadler. You said that it has a hopeful ending. People are actually going to download this film, which I would urge them to do, or indeed purchase it in full. What would you expect them to take away? What are you looking to the outcome of people who actually watch The Last Tourist?
Well, we want to present them with ideas, and there is that message, as I said, the message of hope. But ultimately, we want people to just think differently and understand the power that they have when they decide they want to go on holiday. That's that mindset, that change in how we, look at the decision to go on holiday and the opportunity you have when you say that, and what a privilege it is, because there's so few people on the planet that get to say that I want to go on holiday. When you look at the number of people on the planet and how many people have the opportunity to travel, it's a real privilege, and with that privilege comes great responsibility. And understanding the difference that travel is not a right. You don't have a right to anything when it comes to travel. It is a privilege to travel, and it's a privilege in the Western and developed world that we get the opportunity to travel. And with that comes great responsibility. And if we can just get people to think more like that, and be more connected to the destinations instead of buying amenities, like thread counts on sheets or entertainment like Broadway shows or whatever, then then doing this film would have been well worth it.
Bruce, it's been fascinating sharing some thoughts with your good self. There's so much more we'd like to discuss, but time is obviously a premium in all sorts of ways. As we mentioned, The Last Tourist is available from most streaming platforms across the UK and Ireland. It's well worth actually accessing. Do you have any plans for a sequel? Will it be a case of The Last Tourist plus one, or is it a case of no, we've
Oh,
done it now?
I'm not a filmmaker. I stumbled into this. Tyson, who did the film, is really the creative genius behind the movie. There would be no plans or discussions for me. I learned a lot during the process, and I've enjoyed being part of it. But no, there's no prequel or sequel in my future,
Okay, well,
at the
Bruce,
moment, anyways. Never say never.
very much so. Jamais plus jamais. Well, Bruce, it's been awesome connecting with your good self today.
Thank
And
you.
can we speak again in the near future? Will you come back and be kind enough to join us again to
Would
really
love
share
to.
your thoughts?
Would love to. Thank you.
Okay, well, the cost of living crisis is still with us, and we are clearly still looking at for the lowest prices. But how can we actually look for those lowest prices in a way that makes sense? Well, somebody who can provide some advice for us on that particular area is indeed the savings expert from vouchercodes.co.uk, and that would be Anita Naik. How are you, Anita?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Excellent. So let's talk a little bit about this whole notion about, why British people in particular are so keen to find a deal. I mean, it seems fairly self-evident. We don't want to necessarily play over the odds for things which we can obviously get a bargain for.
Oh, totally. I mean, we're a nation of bargain hunters. I think, apart from the fact we're all feeling the pinch, we've all become much more savvy about getting a deal these days. I mean, there's so many ways to get a deal that I think everyone's always swapping tips and everything. And it's a, you know, it's indicative of our nation, I think.
So the whole notion of a bargain bonanza for British folk basically springs to mind. And, you know, I see we're always looking ahead to Black Friday, which seems scarcely credible as we're just about to enter the summer, basically. But presumably
it does, doesn't it?
It pays to think ahead, really.
It does. I mean, we love Black Friday, but it's just before Christmas, so it's 6 months away. And we know that a third of Brits only shop in big ticket, you know, for big ticket items in sale periods like Black Friday, which is why we've introduced Black Friday, which is to help, you know, all the Brits that want to buy things right now, really, and don't want to wait 6 months.
Well, that makes sense, certainly for the few remaining days that we've actually got left with respect to May. Indeed, we might be heading into June and all sorts of other areas within that. So,
exactly. I mean,
from the cynical point of view, people who actually say, oh, well, yes, it probably sounds too good to be true. It probably is too good to be true. It's not really worthwhile. What would your advice be for people who actually say, well, are there really deals out there?
Oh, my goodness, there's some really great deals. And we've got some great exclusive deals at the moment. We know that 49% of Brits want summer clothes right now. 42% want garden essentials, and 27% are still looking for a holiday. So we've got deals from TUI, John Lewis. Even if you're looking for bank holiday food, you can get 30% off first orders at Ocado right now. So, you know, it's a good time to shop.
So, as I say, taking that whole notion of Black Friday into Black Fry May, do we get sort of more conscious when it comes to looking for bargains when we are actually in the summer scenario? Is it a time where traditionally we tend to ease off the summer scenario, or should we be stocking up for the winter now?
I think stock up for summer. It's a really good time. The weather's getting better. It's a good time to buy garden essentials, you know, pizza oven if you want one, barbecues. Good time to buy summer clothes for the holiday. It's actually a really good time to buy summer clothes. You can get some really great deals right now. But it's actually a good time to buy any big ticket item. You just need to do your research. So I always think whenever you're looking for a deal, sale or not, you should always be checking the price to make sure that you're getting a good deal.
Are we seeing the end of the buy one, get one free scenarios, and it's all about sort of deals for particular aspects, or will they always be part of the shopping experience?
I think it depends what you're looking for. I think for the big ticket items, it was never, you could never really get those deals, but you can get some great deals. It's just, as I said, a good way to make sure you do your research and check things. For instance, at Voucher Codes, all our codes are backed up by the code guarantee, which means that you never leave without the saving you're promised. So it's a really good place to head.
And any final tips, Anita, you'd like to suggest for people who might be relative novices to the whole notion of shopping for the bargain, etc.? What would you advise them to do?
I think before you even buy anything, always research the price across different sites to make sure you're going to get a deal, and then go and look at a discount and see exactly how much you can get off, and you'll be surprised at how much of a saving you can make.
Vouchercodes.co.uk presumably would be the area you'd recommend people should actually check out.
Absolutely.
There you go, savings expert Anita Naik from Voucher Codes UK, vouchercodes.co.uk. I can't even get the words out these days. Many thanks indeed. Take care and happy saving.
Thank you.